Test 1, 2. How we doing? Can you hear me yet? Okay, we're getting there. It's warming up. The tubes are heating up back there. Well, this, I can't tell you what joy it gives me to see a bunch of people coming out on an early Saturday morning to learn about Christian philosophy and apologetics. This is dynamite stuff. I have a sense that this could actually be a big game changer, this kind of thing. As J.P. Moreland already pointed out, Christianity is a knowledge tradition. And when we start to actually offer up good answers, fulfilling that great apologetics command in 1 Peter, be prepared always to give an answer, you know, a reason for the hope that we have, yet do so with humility and reverence. I mean, we start to fulfill that, and it turns things upside down. People really don't know what to do about that. In fact, it reminds me, I'm teaching on the resurrection this morning. It reminds me of a time I got invited to give a talk at the UCLA School of Medicine. I don't get a chance to do this very often. So I get this call from the medical students, and they invite me in to give this talk. And it was a lunchtime lecture series, and they were getting near Easter, and they thought, wouldn't that be funny if we brought in a Christian, you know, to talk about, like, the resurrection, you know? It'd be like a cross-cultural endeavor on our part. So they felt very cool about that. So they called Biola, and I get the operator transfers it to me. I said, oh, yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So I'm driving to UCLA, all prepped to give a lecture to some very bright medical students on the topic of the resurrection. And it dawned on me that, you know what, this is very important. If dead people can come back to life, young medical students need to know something about this. So I get there, and have you ever seen one of those anatomy lecture halls? They're really strange things. They go like straight up in the sky. You know, people sit up there and look down while you're lecturing. They're looking at the slab. You know, who knows that you were dissecting moments before, you know? So I'm giving this talk on the resurrection. It's a lunchtime lecture series. They're all eating sandwiches while they're listening to me, you know, so. And here's my outline for that morning. It was... Jesus was alive at point A, he was dead at point B, and he was alive again at point C. All right? They were stunned. I was stunned that they were stunned. In fact, I mean, they were so stunned I could tell what kind of sandwich they were eating, you know, because their mouths were hanging open, you know? Tuna, you know? It was weird. I didn't really understand why they were so taken aback by this. Hey, there's a UCLA sweatshirt right in the fourth row there. Yeah. And but I didn't have much time for Q&A. But when they were done, a few of them rushed up and started peppering me with questions. And I got the sense for why so many of them were stunned by this. This one guy goes, I think he kind of spoke for the group. Really, he said, I got to tell you, I grew up in a Baptist home and church, you know, and I memorized Bible verses. I won little Awana badges and all kinds of stuff, you know. I remember all that fondly, but I got to tell you, you are making it sound like it's very different. You're making it sound like it's true. You know, he obviously wasn't a philosophy major as an undergraduate, you know. He was wrestling with some terms. How do I express this? And he says, true. But what he really meant was, you're making it sound like I can know it to be true. You see the difference? So many Christians are walking around going, this is really all about me and my faith and my struggle to believe it. I'm going to believe it whether the evidence, you know, indicates it or not, you know. In fact, I even read one definition of faith in a local newspaper one time that said, basically, faith is believing stuff even though you suspect it's not true, you know? Or as Pudd'nhead Wilson said in one of Mark Twain's books, you know, Pudd'nhead Wilson goes, faith is believing what you know ain't so. And that's what these medical students, they thought that's what Christianity was about. It's you know, you kind of grit your teeth, you close your eyes, and you leap into the religious abyss, you know? Crazy stuff. I had a lot of crazy times on college campuses. But that story was meant to highlight the idea that this is a very different operation. Most people don't understand that we're really talking about knowledge here, that you can actually make a case. And like I said last night, this idea that Christianity is testable sets it apart in dramatic fashion from the other great world religious traditions. Yep. Oh, one other quick preliminary. I was at the University of Miami a year or two ago. This is a wild time. I get invited by this big Christian group. They actually had a pretty decent sized Christian group at the University of Miami campus. They set up this lecture on, I was going to talk about reconciling religion and science. It's a pretty big topic, you know. And again, they're offering free food. I guess that's how you get these skeptics out. Skeptics are hungry, you know. And so they fill this lecture hall, and there was, you know, this. We're kind of like in the science center of campus. Lots of scientists out there, you know, grad students with their white lab coats on and the whole thing, you know. There's obviously undergrads and professors and grad students in the audience. And I knew this was going to be a tough gig, you know, especially when I saw people filing in. And so I thought, what could I do? I thought, what could I do with this group? In fact, that's what I told them. I go, you know, it's great. Sometimes you have to look at an audience to know what to do. And it seems to me that if I'm going to address the topic of science and religion, it would probably be very helpful if I perform a miracle. They didn't laugh quite like that. They laughed, but not like that, you know? But it really grabbed their attention. They're like, they're murmuring and looking at each other like, what's he going to do? I go, yeah, I think I'll perform a miracle. So I go out to the edge of the stage and I start to loosen up. Because, you know, you got to loosen up before you perform a miracle. It was so ridiculous. I'm like stretching, you know. And they're just leaning forward like, what's he going to do? This woman down here in the front row, she had a camera, you know. She was going to catch it on film. I go, are you going to try to photograph the miracle? And she goes, can I? I go, you can try, you know? It was all so crazy. And so I shake down. It was a hush just like that. No kidding. And this is all I do. Other side, you know? And they're just going, you know, they weren't eating sandwiches, but, you know, their mouths were open like, but it was more of like, what a moron kind of look, you know? And I go, there it is. Thank you very much. And they're just kind of like, what was that? And I said, okay, can anybody explain what just happened? See, there was a little bit of method to my madness. Can anybody explain what just happened? And, you know, people were throwing out ideas. In fact, then this one guy stands up, white lab coat, you know, overhead projector pens in his pocket, he's balding, glasses. Like, he was like, from Central Casting, science guy, you know? So crazy. So he stands up and he goes, here's what happened. And he gave this he must have been a professor of physiology because he gave this amazing rendition of all the electrochemical, physiological events that take place to cause your arm to go up. There's C fibers firing and there's acetylcholine and there's synapses and there's action potentials and there's this, that, and the other. And, you know, the nerve goes down, it goes out cervical gap, blah, and it goes down to the deltoid muscle where it connects. Once the action potential gets to a certain point, actin and myosin cross over and up goes the arm. And we're like, yo, wow. I mean, everybody was amazed how well this guy did in terms of just giving the details, the basic physiological details of what happened to make my arm go up. And so even I was stunned. I go, wow, that was terrific. But obviously incomplete. Can somebody help him? You know. As you know, nobody was going to go against Professor so-and-so, you know. So then they were starting to get mad at me, you know. I have been run off a campus or two, so you never know. And so they started to shout things at me, you know, like, help him out, you know. And some of them were just kind of yelling at me. But this one gal in the front row, right next to the gal with the camera, I couldn't hear her at first because there's kind of a lot of murmuring. She was shouting something at me and kind of leaned forward. And I heard her say, you did it, you know, you did it. And I said, wait a minute, what'd you say? She goes, you did it. I go, everybody, shh, listen to what she said. Tell everybody what you just said. She goes, he did it. You know, to the audience. And I go, she's right. I did it. You see, I am not my body. I am tightly associated with my body. I can make it do all kinds of things, you know? And I gotta tell you, if you hold to a worldview that cannot understand this basic motion, in other words, the origin of that motion, you can talk about the cascade of electrochemical events that make that arm go up all day long, but guess what? I actually taught physics for a period of time, and according to Newton's laws, I was a body at rest. And a body remains at rest unless acted upon by an outside force, right? Well, there was no fishing line tied to my arm. right? Pulling it up from the rafters. There was no wind blowing through the room. It was Miami, but there's no hurricane. So what in the world? How did my arm go up? And you know, they were having a terrible time with that. And this guy gives this wonderful explanation, but still they weren't capturing it. I go, what initiated it? Come on, people. And then this guy goes, you did it. You did it. I go, you're right. I did it. I'm not my body. I'm tightly associated with this. And guess what? I willed it to happen. And the will is not something that can be studied by chemistry and physics, is it? A choice is not something that can be studied by chemistry and physics. You can't put a choice or a thought in a bottle, you know? It doesn't have mass, it doesn't have charge, it doesn't have wavelength. But nonetheless, it's real. And that's what I was confronting with this group, that there's something more to life than simply the stuff of the physical world. And that was news to them. And there were a lot of people who were arguing with me. In fact, there was a line of people. About half of them were holding their laptops. The reason they were holding their laptops, because they were convinced that their laptops were in some ways persons. And they were going to introduce me. This is a problem for future relationships when they think their computers are, you know, like some sort of people. They have like relationships with their computers. It's a very odd situation. So pay close attention to what Dr. Moreland has to say this afternoon. He will address some of those things. But we have a great time out on the college campuses. This morning, I would like to talk about the resurrection of Jesus, give you a quick introduction of a survey of an overview of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I'm still working my way through the latest book on the resurrection, which is written by a colleague across the country. By his name is Michael Lacone. It's about 700 pages, you know. And he's just dealing with the documentary sources that point to the resurrection. This is a huge field of study, and we actually know more about it now than we did 25 years ago. And I think, I'll give you the conclusion at the beginning, I think you'll discover that we've got the goods on this. You are well within your epistemic rights, to use a philosophical term. You're well within your epistemic rights, your rights of knowledge to say, I know the resurrection happened. What does that mean? Well, it means you are able to give excellent reasons for your beliefs, and I'll talk about that. Quick couple of announcements, though. Told the guys out there I plugged some of their stuff. Mikel Del Rosario, who's going to be speaking here, I think after me, he's got these wonderful sets of materials. You can access them online. They will help you teach your way through this material. He's the apologetics guy in this area, and you want to take full advantage of his knowledge and expertise. He's a graduate of the MA program with distinction in Christian apologetics from Biola, so pay close attention to his table and what he's doing. There's a chapter of reasonable faith opening in this area. Reasonable faith is an organization started by my colleague William Lane Craig. I mentioned his debate last night. And they've got all kinds of things going on at the table. Special lectures coming up, community barbecues. So check out the table and find out what's going on over there. Some of you were in here to hear Harry Edwards this morning. Harry Edwards and his close associates at apologetics.com, they have a radio program, they have all kinds of things. They come out with this interesting new book called Think and Live. This is like edgy, fast-paced reading. It's really fun to read, and they deal with like all the big apologetic topics in a fascinating way. These are almost like transcripts from their radio dialogues, which are very interesting. So check that out at the apologetics.com table. One other thing, some of you have been asking me, what's the one like book I could get on apologetics to get me started? This is a very good one. We've got a small stack of them out on the table. It's called To Everyone an Answer. I think this is probably the best single volume book in apologetics that you can get your hands on today. Who knows? Maybe next week there'll be a new contender for the throne, but here's a good one, To Everyone an Answer. It's got essays written by top people in the field. In fact, I think I've got one. J.P. Moreland's got one. You know, William Lane Craig, my friend Frank Beckwith, Gary Habermas, Josh McDowell, you name it. They're all in here and addressing things in their specialty. Enough of that. So, I claimed last night that Christianity is testable, and that actually sets it apart from the other great world religious traditions. And I said, I would read to you one of the strangest passages in all of religious literature. You're not going to find something like this in the Buddhist Tripitaka or the Book of Mormon or the Quran. It comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And this really sets the stage. I like this verse so much. I've actually ruined Bibles at this particular point in the binding, you know, because I open it there so much. This really is an astonishing passage. I'm starting with verse 12 in chapter 15. Paul writes this. But if it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Wait a minute. Well, he continues. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. But he did not raise him if, in fact, the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. Faith is empty. Your faith is worthless. Your faith is futile. If Jesus did not come back from the dead. You see how important that is. Jesus claimed his coming back from the dead was going to be the great sign. This is really the stamp. This is the marker. This is the thing that sets it apart. And by the way, it makes some people nervous. When I read a passage like that one time in a kind of a liberal Presbyterian church, they came up afterwards and said, yeah, you know, you got to be careful with stuff like that, you know? Because, I mean, what if it didn't happen, you know? You know, that was a viable option. I go, look, if it didn't happen, you got bigger fish to fry than my reading the Bible in your church. But that really is, it stuns a lot of people. Like, oh my goodness, when they really kind of meditate on that. I can guarantee, you know, if you've ever studied Zen Buddhism does not care if the Buddha ever existed or if the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path of the Deer Park in Benares. They don't care anything about that. It's really all about what goes on inside the Zen Buddhist. Is the Zen Buddhist making progress towards enlightenment? It's all internal. Now, very often we sound just like Zen Buddhists because we only talk about the internal. Right? We only talk about that which we are feeling. In fact, sometimes we even link it to the resurrection. You ask me how I know he lives? He lives within my heart. By the way, I don't want to dilute that for a second because that is huge and it's a great truth and I bank on that every day and sometimes that's the most meaningful part of the whole business to me, that he lives in my heart. I know he's with me, teaching me and guiding me. I mean, he's real to me. And he lives in my heart. But that doesn't end there. It turns out that there's a tremendous trail of evidence leading back through history testifying that he doesn't just live in my heart, he lives in his body, which came back from the grave on the third day, exactly as the scriptures declare. So we got the goods on this. It is funny, though. I remember some people even have trouble whether Jesus existed or died. You know, did he really die? I went to my relative's house one time. I don't know who he is. You know, do you have those relatives where there have been so many marriages and rearrangements in your family, you can't identify the person relationally who you're sitting next to at Thanksgiving dinner? You know, I'll call him Alan. He's a relative of some sort. He invites me and my family over for, Christmas dinner. And so we're arriving and he's an armchair agnostic. He's a retired guy. He plays golf and he watches television and he's very good at both of them. So whenever I walk in, he knows I'm the God boy, you know? And so he sees me coming, and if I'm going in to greet him in the television room, he'll see me coming, and he'll grab the remote like a Western gunslinger, you know? And start going, doo, 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 you know, looking for the most outrageous religious programming you can possibly find, you know? People with gigantic hair, you know, people with blazing white Nehru jackets, people frothing and falling and, you know, and so I'll walk into the room and he'll look at me and go, hey, here's your people. You know? But this one time I walk in and it was like during Christmas. And so he sees me come and he grabs the remote and it's like, doo, doo, doo. He didn't get very far, you know, because he landed on this like documentary about the historical Jesus. It always cracks me up, you know, like the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and all that. They play religious programming near our religious holidays because they figure we religious people want that kind of stuff, you know. All right, I'll let him have that. But this documentary was fairly interesting. Now, it featured mostly liberal scholars, but they actually threw in a couple of conservatives, which was fine by me. I think they held their own and did a good job. But it was a biography of Jesus, and it was very interesting. They showed like 3D models of ancient Jerusalem, what Jesus might have looked like based on these skeletal features of ancient Semitic men and so on. Really interesting stuff. So we were both like transfixed by it, watching it. Well, if they're doing a biography of Jesus, eventually they're going to get to his death, right? And so a title comes up and it goes, you know, The Crucifixion, you know? And then they interview scholars sitting in front of books or out in the quad, you know, or out in the field, you know? And they interview the scholars, and to a person on the issue of the crucifixion, done deal, take to the bank, knowable history. Every person, whether liberal, radical, conservative, whatever, affirmed that Jesus was indeed a real historical figure, and he died by Roman crucifixion in first century Jerusalem. Done deal. Anybody who stands against that is basically on the kook fringe. Okay, and this is even by the radicals who are saying this, all right? Well, then they get to the next title sequence, you know, The Resurrection. And they interview the exact same set of scholars in front of the exact same books and out in the same quads and so on. And except for the couple of conservatives, right, in the crowd, almost every one of them said something like, well, who can possibly know what happened so long, long ago in those tumultuous times, you know? That's the sound of my head hitting the coffee table. And I'm yelling at the television, and now I'm the one frothing and falling, you know? And I'm yelling at the television, oh my goodness, they can't do that. Wait a second, the exact same body of evidence that led them all to conclude beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus was killed at the hands of a Roman crucifixion team in first century Jerusalem is the exact same body of evidence, one page over, that tells us he came back from the dead. Oh my goodness, you know, it really dawned on me at that point that this is not about evidence. This is about people's worldviews. Most of the scholars they were interviewing simply weren't open to the idea of a miracle. Now, I'm not going to deal with the topic of miracles, but they weren't open to the idea of a miracle. You know, it seems to me that we're often called narrow-minded. I learned something in my religious studies program, which is a very wild and crazy program for a conservative Christian to be in. I learned something that my worldview tended to be quite broad compared to my liberal colleagues. They had a very narrow view of the world, which could not include any report of a miracle. Interesting. We actually have, you know, I don't think we ought to adopt every report of a miracle as authentic, but you know what? If there's excellent reason to believe that a supernatural event has taken place, I think we ought to be open to such a thing. And in the terms of Jesus' return from the dead, I think this is a bona fide miracle that took place, and there's excellent reason to believe it. So, well, how are we going to approach this? I mean, we teach whole semester courses on this. I'll give you sort of the quick and dirty method. And this is something that you can use probably tomorrow with your skeptical relatives over Sunday evening dinner. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. Back in the day, when I first became a Christian, you know, there was books like More Than a Carpenter and Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And those are wonderful books. And I learned a lot, and it really grounded me in the faith in terms of apologetics, reading that kind of material. But that approach isn't quite as effective today. Now, what was the old approach, the kind of the Josh McDowell approach? It would be to open up the New Testament, make the case that the New Testament is historically reliable, and then go into the pages, into the text, to find out what it says about the resurrection of Jesus and see if that's reasonable to believe based on the text. See, that doesn't work anymore, and it's not a problem with the method, it's a problem with the people on these secular college campuses who hear this kind of stuff. Because the moment you walk on their campus and you open up the text of Scripture, whether you're going to give it a robust defense, you know, very objective, scholarly defense or whatever, it doesn't matter. You're holding a Bible. And the Bible's evil, and therefore you are evil. you know? No, really, the moment you get the Bible out, it's like, oh, no, don't go there. We're talking about literature that is homophobic, misogynist, you know, and violent and just nasty on many fronts. Sure, I'm sure there's some wonderful teachings in there, but it's just overrun with nastiness, you know? And so you can't get a good hearing. It's very difficult to make your case when they simply shut their ears immediately. So I think it's incumbent upon us as the creative people of God to have new methods. I always try to open up side doors and side windows to bring Christian truth into people. In fact, that's why I wrote a novel instead of writing yet another apologetics textbook. And guaranteed more people have read that than have read, you know, standard apologetics works. And I get these emails from agnostics and atheists and so on, saying, wait a minute, I'm totally intrigued by this, you know, because I brought it in through the side doors. I mean, there are agnostic professors who actually assign this for their students to read because it's so refreshing and interesting. They love the main character. The book is called Five Sacred Crossings. The main character is a college professor, you know, of course. You're right about what you know. So we need interesting new side doors. And the method I'm going to present to you was developed first by a colleague of mine. He actually teaches the resurrection course in our program in apologetics at Biola, Gary Habermas. And he invented this technique, which is very effective. And it's my favorite technique for the secular university campuses, but really for anybody. And here's the technique. Rather than just grabbing the Bible and opening it up and making our case from the text, what if we did this? What if we read our harshest critics, you know, people with top degrees in religious studies, in history, and theology, and biblical studies, and so on. Now, these are not believers, by and large, all right? These are skeptics and critics. These would be the people who would have been going, whoa, you know, who knows what happened so many years ago, you know? It would be that kind of person, and they write books, and sometimes they're very big books on these kinds of topics. What if we read through their material and gathered up the set of facts that they believe are true? Interesting. Okay, let's do that. Well, that's what you have. Now, if you have your program, this will be very helpful, these handouts. If you don't have one, you can, well, if God doesn't exist, you can beat up your neighbor and take it from them. I'm not going to deal with page 13. That's kind of an outline for a general case for Christianity. I won't have time for that. But if you turn the page, actually turn to page 16. That's where I'm going to start. Page 16. Because what I have on page 16 are 12 known facts concerning the resurrection events, right? These are facts that are derived from our harshest critics. And if you want to know where to find who these critics are, right? You really want to do some research on this. You can go to GaryHabermas.com. I think it's .com, might be .org or something, but Gary Habermas, HABERMAS.com.org. You'll find him. He's got his whole doctoral dissertation accessible online there. And so you can go through all of the sources from which he derives these basic facts. So you see the technique. We're going to use our critics, and then we're going to have a set of facts, and then we're going to see where those take us. So let me walk through these 12 known facts with you, and I'll give a comment or two on each one as we go through. Number one, Jesus died by crucifixion, right? Obviously, Jesus existed as a real historical figure, and he died by crucifixion. Interestingly, these facts don't say much. Right, they're not long paragraphs. They're simple statements, and they're meant to be. They're called minimal facts. They're simply stated very carefully and succinctly so that everybody can buy into them. The moment you start adding a lot of detail, you know, people start falling off the wagon, so we keep them very minimal. Jesus died by crucifixion. By the way, the reason this is a known historical fact today is even modern skeptical scholars have discovered something. People die by crucifixion. Yeah. They don't almost die, you know, they don't lounge around on the cross and then, you know, go do something else later in the afternoon. They die, right? In fact, one reason they were able to find this out is through some medical research where they would take graduate students into laboratories and crucify them. Literally. I mean, now they wouldn't drive the nails through, but they could tie a person to a cross beam and see what kind of physical responses there are, you know? And it's very distressing. In fact, if you're just hanging there by your arms, you're going to die very quickly because you can't get air exchange. And so if you have a little peg to stand on and you could push up, you can get a breath in. But then you're hanging down here. It's very difficult to get a breath. You can't get good enough air exchange. Your diaphragm can't go down and your intercostal muscles can't expand. You can't get that negative pressure for a good breath. And so you got to push up. And so when you're being crucified, it's excruciating to push up, right? In fact, that's where we get the word, excruciating. You got a nail through your feet, so every time you push up, it's agonizing. Now, Jesus and some of these people who were being crucified were very strong people, and they could last a number of hours on the cross. And remember in the Gospel of John, the sun was about to go down. They wanted to hasten their death. What were they going to do? They were going to go and break their legs. What would that do? Well, it'd make it so they really weren't pushing up anymore. I mean, a couple of times like that, and you're just like, I'm gone. And they will just hang and die. One of my students one time, it's kind of an irreverent comment, said, yeah, I get it. It's kind of like one of those old pop-up buttons on turkeys. You know when it's done, right? When you're just hanging there, not pushing up anymore, you're dead. So modern scholars think, you know what? Jesus died by crucifixion. It was an excellent way of killing people, and you knew when they were dead, because they didn't push up to get breaths anymore. Number two, Jesus was buried. Jesus was buried. Notice we're not elaborating, but he was buried in one way or another. I think we're near the point where we can say he was buried in the rock-hewn tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Critical scholars are really warming up to that idea, and I won't go into all the reasons, but it has to do with the criterion of embarrassment and so on. But he was buried. Number three, Jesus' death caused the disciples to despair and lose hope, believing that his life was ended. Right? Now, don't forget, even the skeptics agree to this stuff. Number four, the tomb was discovered to be empty just a few days later. The empty tomb is embraced by most critical scholars. The reason is it pops up in every source that the critical scholars think is important. So the empty tomb pops up over and over again. You got to deal with an empty tomb if you're talking about this resurrection story of Jesus. Number five, the disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances of the risen Jesus. Okay? Critical scholars agree. Oh yeah, there were disciples and they really, really, really thought they saw the Jesus in his physical body. Now, of course, they were wrong, but that they claimed to have those experiences. And they really believed that they were seeing this. Number six, in fact, you might want to put a little star by number six because this is quite a fact. The disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify themselves with Jesus to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. How are you going to explain that? How are you going to explain those people just running and cowering and going back and fishing and suddenly they're out, you know, giving their lives for this great cause? That is tough stuff. I don't know how that's going to be explained apart from a resurrection. I'm not sure you need the rest of these facts. Number six alone might do all of the heavy lifting necessary. Number seven, the message, that is the resurrection message, was the center of preaching in the early church. Well, that's interesting. Think about that. How did the resurrection become the center of preaching in the early church if it didn't happen? In other words, if it's sort of legendary or later developed through, you know, legends that were told around campfires through the years and so on. How did the resurrection become the center point of preaching? Why not something else? Why not some part of the Sermon on the Mount or, you know, love your neighbor? Something could have been the center point of preaching, but no, the resurrection became the thing that the followers of Jesus were wild about and they couldn't stop talking about. There is one explanation. He came back from the dead and was so astonished and they just couldn't stop talking. And you see how the resurrection makes good on a lot of these basic facts. Number eight, this message, again, the resurrection message, was especially proclaimed in Jerusalem, where Jesus died and was buried shortly before. If the resurrection is a fabrication or a legend that developed over time, you wouldn't expect it to develop in Jerusalem in the lifetime of the people who were witnesses of these things. You would expect to develop in Antioch or Corinth or Alexandria, maybe Rome, someplace like that, where people had to, risk their lives to sail back to the old country to really find out the scoop here. You know, people weren't really amenable to doing that kind of work in order to do some investigative reporting. So you would expect it to develop in other lands, not in Jerusalem, but it developed in Jerusalem, and that's where it radiated out. Number 9, as a result of this preaching, the church was born and grew. I've read a lot of books in historical sociology. These are religious sociologists trying to make sense of the origin of the Christian church. It is very difficult to do. I've gone to conferences where people just sit around scratching their heads going, how in the world do you explain the origin of the Christian church? Because everything was set against it. Everything was set against it. There were movements with much greater promise, that didn't make it. And yet Christianity with so little promise breaks through and makes it. I mean, you compare this to, say, Islam. Islam, it's easy to understand how it spread. You know, Muhammad and his close associates raised an army. All right? They get enough swords and enough guys, and you go into the next country, and you co-opt it for Islam, right? So it's easy to understand that, but not with Christianity. Christianity was a religion of persuasion from the beginning, and to think that it could actually make its way through the Roman Empire is very difficult to understand, unless, of course, a resurrection took place. And people, I gotta tell everybody about this, that this is craziness. I mean, people would be willing to risk an awful lot after having seen or heard eyewitness testimony that Jesus had come back from the dead. Suddenly, your own mortal life takes on different meaning, doesn't it? It's not the end for you. Number 10. 10 is very powerful. Sunday became the primary day of worship. Sunday became the primary day of worship. Why is that powerful? Well, where did Christianity start? With a bunch of practicing Jewish people, for goodness sakes. How long have they been meeting on the Sabbath and worshiping on the Sabbath and revering the Sabbath, which was sundown Friday to sundown Saturday? Thousands of years. How easy is it to discard a thousands of year practice, to start worshiping, which is a very center point of religious activity? How do they move their day of worship from the Sabbath to suddenly Sunday morning? That has to be explained. Well, there is one explanation. Jesus came back from the dead, and they were so astonished by it, right, that they threw out everything and started to worship on the day he came back from the dead because that was the new center point for their existence. Number 11 and 12, James in 11, who had been a skeptic, was converted to the faith when he also believed he saw the resurrected Jesus. In 12, a few years later, Paul was converted by an experience which he likewise believed to be an appearance of the risen Jesus. Now, there are a lot more facts we could list here. If we just crack open the New Testament, there's tons of stuff we could put on our list. But that's not the game we're playing, is it? We're simply reading the critics and listing the things that they would be completely okay with. And they are. So it seems to me that we're well within our rights to call this knowable history. When you've got a batch of data that conservatives like me and radicals all can embrace as true, I think we've got some good material to work with. Now, what do we do next? Well, we're good scientists, right? So we've got these data points, and we want to get a theory together that captures all the data points. Now, doesn't that sound scientific? Doesn't that just warm your scientific heart? This is why it drives me nuts when people go, oh, you're a Christian, it's all about blind faith, And you've experienced this. You've been at work, and maybe you had a Bible on your desk, and somebody walks by, and they give it the old double take, like, a Bible? Oh, you're a religious person. Good for you. You know what they're thinking. Yeah, some people believe in leprechauns too, That's what they're thinking. But I think this is very scientific. We've got a set of data points that I can agree with, that radicals can agree with, and now we're going to try on a set of theories. And there are a finite number of theories. There are only a few plausible ones that you can work with in historical studies. But let's look at a few of these. And for this exercise, you'll need this chart on page 14 and 15. This will help guide this. In fact, you'll need to look at that and flip back to the 12 known historical facts. Flipping back and forth will be a healthy exercise during this. So we're going to try on a few facts. And what I've got here in this chart is the tomb of Jesus was either occupied or it was empty, right? So you've got a group of occupied tomb theories and you've got a group of empty tomb theories. Then you follow the lines down and there are a bunch of names like unknown tomb, wrong tomb, legend, and so on. Those are names of theories that have come down through the centuries. And then the numbers at the bottom correspond to the 12 known facts that I presented to you. And the numbers listed are the facts that do not fit that particular theory. So we're looking for none, or you know, all the data fits. That's what we're looking for. Well, let's try a few of these on for size. I'll start out with I'll start with the unknown tomb theory. This isn't going to impress you, but it's all the way on the left of your chart here, and we'll just start there. The unknown tomb theory, this was hot stuff at the end of the 19th century, in France especially. The theory said this: the body of Jesus was buried in a common pit grave unknown to his disciples. Therefore, the resurrection account arose out of the ignorance as to the whereabouts of the body. Right? Yeah, that's not doing it for you. And it certainly is not helping with the evidence. And you can see that it misses on data points numbers 4 through 12. Jesus died. He's thrown into a common pit grave. Nobody can find his body. So rumors begin to circulate about his resurrection. That's not a very good explanation. In fact, it misses on all kinds of things. Like number 4, the tomb was discovered to be empty just a few days later. How do you get an empty tomb story floating when you've got that explanation? The disciples had experiences which they believed were literal appearances of the risen Jesus. The disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify themselves with Jesus to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. It became the center point of preaching. It was proclaimed in Jerusalem. The church was born and grew. Sunday becomes the primary day of worship. James and Paul have these experiences of the risen Jesus. How is that explained by a body they lost in a common pit grave? It's not. And so, thank God, that one is really not on the scene right now. Scholars know better. But it gives you an example of the kinds of things we're working with. There's the wrong tomb theory, which you can see by the numbers is one data point better. One data point better. It helps us with number 4, right? And what's number 4? You're going to be a faster flipper than I am. Number 4 is the tomb is discovered to be empty just a few days later. It actually understands that one. So Jesus is put in a tomb, but he's around the corner, you know? And so the disciples go to the wrong tomb and they find it empty and the rumor starts that he's come back from the dead. It accounts for the empty tomb, but it misses on all kinds of other data points. You know, this one strikes me as strange. In fact, here's what it says. The women came to the wrong tomb, for there were many similar tombs in Jerusalem. They found an open tomb and a young man who denied that this was Jesus' tomb. The frightened women mistakenly identified the man as an angel and fled. That's what the wrong, in its classic statement, that's the theory of the wrong tomb. We all know this right up front is not true, because as we established last night, women ask for directions. So they would have gone to the right tomb, you know. I could totally imagine that. You could imagine Peter going to the wrong tomb, you know. Do you know where you're going, Peter? Totally, dude. You know, and going to the wrong one, and the rumor starts. But it misses, although it helps on point number 4, it misses on all the rest. It doesn't explain Paul and James seeing Jesus. It doesn't explain the disciples being transformed, you know, willing to give their lives for this cause and so on. So let's move to another one, the legend theory. The legend theory. This is pretty obvious, really. The legend theory says the resurrection was a fabrication that evolved over a lengthy period to vindicate a leader long since dead. You know how this goes, you know. In fact, this would be the most popular theory by far. If you listen to talk radio, you talk to your neighbor, even if you talk to people who go to churches very often, they think this is the way it goes. Well, you know, you can't take that stuff too seriously. It's kind of a legend, you know. They were primitive people and they would tell stories around campfires, you know. And after a generation or two of that, pretty soon that Jesus was probably a nice guy and all.
He's walking on water. He's multiplying loaves and fishes, and he's conquering death. You know, we know how that goes. Those are religious legends. How does it do with the data? Oh, my. It's actually the worst one of all of them. It's by far the most popular, hands down, but it's the worst in dealing with the actual facts in the case. It doesn't make sense of any of the facts, Numbers 1 through 12. It's a real mess. So you ought to point that out to your skeptical neighbors and coworkers. Look, go get a better theory, because that one is the worst of all, right? There's the I don't want to skip over this beauty, the twin theory. This is clever, and it only misses on two data points, so it's not a bad theory given the spectrum that we have to deal with here. The twin theory basically says that Jesus A is on the scene, right? And he's in Jerusalem, and they crucify him, and he dies, and they put him in the tomb. 3 days later, Jesus B, his identical twin brother, comes on the scene and says, "Lo, it is I," you know, because that's what religious guys say. And they worship him as the risen Jesus. Huh? Maybe. Maybe not. By the way, this theory does not work well when you open up the rest of the New Testament. You know, you couldn't imagine Mary forgetting about this. You know, the Gospel of Luke went and investigated all of these things. He may have interviewed Mary herself. Mary would not have forgotten that there were two babies in there, and that one of them was carried off by wolves from the manger and raised by, you know, vagabonds in another region. It's not something she would have forgotten. So it doesn't make a lot of sense if you open up the rest of the New Testament. But it misses on data point number 4, which is very important. The tomb was discovered to be empty just a few days later. So Jesus A dies and is buried. Jesus B comes on the scene, lo, it is I. And people are a little skeptical. What do? You go look at the tomb. I mean, you're looking at Jesus B and you're going, why do you have a farmer's tan? And Jesus A had a carpenter's tan? I don't understand this. You know, hey, resurrection does strange things to you. You know, healed my hands too. You know, you can imagine that kind of craziness. I also put number 11 is a problematic point for this. Number 11, James, who had been a skeptic, was converted to the faith when he also believed he saw the resurrected Jesus. Why is that important? It was his brother. Nah, you know, it was his brother. You sure mom wouldn't have told him about this twin brother? You know, I think he would have known something about that. Let's say he didn't. Let's say it was a very carefully guarded secret. That's why I put conspiracy under. There had to be a conspiracy in this in order for it to work, in order for Jesus B to come on the scene at just the right time, in order to have it hidden from guys like James and so on. But let's say Jesus B comes on the scene. He speaks with a different dialect. He looks a little bit different after all those years. And James was going, gosh, I don't know, there's something fishy about this. James could have pulled one of these on him, you know. Hey, Jesus. Yeah, James. Good to see you, Jesus. Hey, great thing you came back from the dead and all. Yeah, glad to be here. Hey, you know, remember growing up with Dad? You know, remember when he used to eat spaghetti? You know, he'd get like one long noodle and be all covered in sauce and he'd suck real hard and start to spin like a propeller and cover us with sauce. Do you remember that, Jesus? And Jesus goes, yeah, that was something. And James goes, gotcha. You know, Dad hated spaghetti, you know? And then James could go down to the tomb and they'll find that Jesus A was buried there and the whole thing would be revealed. You see, the twin theory is not bad given the kinds of theories we have to work with, but it's got some real miserable features that don't make it viable. We move on to things like the hallucination theory, which was popular about a decade ago. Gerd Ludemann, a German scholar, was promoting this one. I won't get into the details on that. In fact, I'll skip a few of them here. Existential resurrection, spiritual resurrection. Existential resurrection says he didn't rise in his own body. He simply lives in our hearts, you know? Spiritual resurrection, that would be something akin to what the Jehovah's Witnesses believe, that Jesus did not come back physically. He rose spiritually. Then you move over into the empty tomb theories like the disciples stole the body, the authorities hid the body. Those never made a lot of sense to me. You can compare these facts and such to these basic theories along the way. There's the swoon theory. Now, the swoon theory only misses on two data points, so it's not a bad one. The swoon theory says this.
Jesus did not die on the cross. He fainted from exhaustion. The cold temperature and spices revived him. All right? Now, we've already established point number one. You know, Jesus died by crucifixion. Even the critical scholars believe that Jesus died. He did not almost die. But let's give it the benefit of the doubt for a moment. So Jesus is on the cross. His breathing is very shallow. His pulse is barely perceptible. They think he's dead. They bring him down from the cross. They carry him off to the tomb. They wrap him in the first round of spiced linens. They put him in the tomb. They close the door, and it is cool in there. In the cool of the tomb, and the aromatic spice is acting like a kind of smelling salt, he wakes up. No, stay with me. This gets totally implausible. Now, don't forget, he's been flogged nearly to death and then crucified, okay? And then he unwraps 70 pounds of linens, you know, tosses them aside. And he either digs tunnels out or moves the stone himself in his weakened condition. Then he either sneaks past the guard or overpowers them, you know? And then he makes his way into Jerusalem, you know, in the center of town. I always picture him like the mummy because he's got these wrappings on him. And he gets, and of course he's a male, so he doesn't ask for directions, and he makes a wrong turn or two. But he finally finds where the disciples are, and he knocks very weakly, you know. He's slumped down a little bit. They open the little hatch to see who's out there, you know. They closed it because they didn't see anybody. He'd already slumped down to the, you know, floorboards. He knocks again weakly. They open the door this time, and they find him in a heap right there at the door. What do? They say, glory, hallelujah, he is risen indeed. No, they go, oh my goodness, Jesus. And they pick him up and they put him on a donkey and they transport him to, you know, Jerusalem General for some, you know, emergency room treatment is what they do. And some even liberal scholars have made this point that it really misses on data point number 6. The disciples were transformed from doubters who were afraid to identify themselves with Jesus to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. A Jesus who barely survived crucifixion would not be a transformative figure. He'd be a guy who barely survived a crucifixion, you know? You would have great doubts calling him the Lord of glory who has conquered death and so on, you know? You're going, not sure. He wasn't just the guy who barely survived a crucifixion. No, when Jesus came back from the dead, it was obvious that he had done something big. He had conquered death, and he was appearing in his new body that was transformative when it encountered the people who were witnesses. Good question. What do the swoon theory people do about the spear that was stuck into his side in the Gospel of John? That's a good question because it highlights something. Remember, we're just sticking with 12 known facts. You see, the critics, the people who disagree with us in regard to the truth of the resurrection and the reliability of the Bible, don't think that ever happened. They don't ever use the Gospel of John. They think it's totally suspect, written way too late, and it's not authenticated enough. So they set it aside. So we're only using the sources that they think are reliable. I won't get into the Passover plot, but here's one. Jesus was an alien. Wow. Either Jesus was an alien or he came back bodily from the grave. I think those are our only two choices. Thank you very much. Okay, what about this alien thing? I didn't used to have this on the list, but then I went to some like New Age Fair or Whole Earth Expo or something like that. And there was a booth. It's like the Jesus was an alien booth, you know? Well, of course, I spent all day talking to these guys. Nobody else was talking to them, and they were so affirmed, you know, that I was there talking to them. And it's so funny because they had obviously watched way too much Star Trek. I mean, they were talking about cloaked spaceships and tractor beams and transporters. I mean, they were making a case like, what if they built an android that looked exactly like Jesus? They could even sprinkle like Jesus' DNA on him. And they beam him in and the real Jesus out just when they're about to hammer the nails in. Well, this android they created could handle this kind of thing. And they could send down a signal and turn him off, you know, and reboot him in the tomb. And it all makes sense. It was kind of craziness. But listening to these guys for a while, I go, you know what? You guys might be right. And they're like, really? You know? I said, yeah. Now, I think the context is a little off kilter, but you're right. Jesus came back from the dead at the hands of a superior power.
you know? In other words, but you think it was the cloaked mothership, you know, sending down the beams, you know, to do all this work. But rather, there's excellent reason to believe that the Father did this by his supernatural power. So you're right in that Jesus was an alien, but not a spaceman alien. He was an alien to us as humans. He was the second Adam, the conqueror of death. And we have excellent reason to believe that he did indeed come back from the dead. You can set all those other theories aside. The one to go with is the tomb of Jesus was empty, and it was a supernatural cause, a bodily resurrection, and it fits all of the data. How is that not scientific? How is that, even if we're wrong, we have made a wonderful, objective, scholarly case, starting with the facts our critics agree with. My goodness, it doesn't get any more objective and fair than that. You can see why this plays well on a secular university campus, because we're really listening carefully to them and using the facts that they believe are worthy of using. So that's what we've got. In fact, I'm gonna just close in prayer, because this is a big deal. This idea that Jesus came back from the dead. In a room this size, there are people facing death. There are you, not only yourself, but people you know are facing death. This is monumental hope. This isn't just some, oh, I hope it's true, I hope it's true, I hope it's true. We can know that this happened. If you have put your trust in Jesus Christ, you will live forever. You will be reunited with a robust body designed for eternity. Praise God. Our Heavenly Father, our great King, what a joy it is to know that you have left a tremendous trail of evidence back through history testifying about your son's death and a glorious resurrection from the dead on our behalf. Father, we couldn't be more grateful. Help us to be like the first witnesses and to embrace this and to let it sink in deeply and to be bold proclaimers of the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ, even unto sacrificing our own lives for it, because Lord, this ain't the end. You have a wonderful plan for us for eternity. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.